Mr. Mann, reel 12. What happened next, Mr. Mann?
The end of the tank, and then what happened? I went down sick. So the sergeant lady said, "Get away and see the medical officer," which I did. This was out of the lines, and the medical officer said, "I want a sample of your urine." So I had to hunt about find a bottle to put that in. In this village, and I found one of these green, I suppose like a poison bottle or something like that. So I gave him a sample of my urine in that, and when I went back, I got a right rollicking there because he couldn't see the colour of the urine through the coloured bottle. Anyhow, I sorted that out and what it amounted to. I got the other jaundice. And from there, I was sent to the nearest field hospital. I suppose it was a good point in getting the jaundice really, while so that it was uncomfortable because I had been sick for a day or two before that.
What date would this be?
This would be in 43 it would be. And we went to the field hospital, and then from there I was actually evacuated on a hospital ship down to Bari in southern Italy. And personally, I felt a bit embarrassed. Just having jaundice, I didn't have any bandage or anything like that. And there's all these wounded soldiers on there. There was some of them, you couldn't see them for bandages around them in this state. And I mean, to me, it was embarrassing. I couldn't help it. I was jaundice, I hadn't asked for it. This was it. They sent me down to Bali with the wounded soldiers. Around the docks, you were on stretchers. I wasn't allowed to walk onto the boat. I remember that. I think it was around the corner where the boat sailed from, but I'm not sure on there. But anyhow, it was on this dockside, and we were all carried onto the boats. And of course, there were some of the lads there, sorry, from mourning and groaning with the pain that they were in. And some of them, of course, had lost limbs as well, and they'd only had the treatment they could get from a field hospital, which wasn't really a hospital. It was, maybe say, a luxury first aid post or something like that. When he went down to Bali, I was in the hospital there, I can't just remember, maybe about a fortnight or something. And from the field hospital, I was put into a transit camp.
What was the treatment for jaundice?
The treatment was like Lord Chicken was one of the things on the menu, but it happened to be any acidy or spicy sort of food, as plain a food as possible. And there was no drinking a drop of vino or anything like that. It was all plain water, flushing you out, cleaning you out. And they gave us some sort of pills to take. I don't know what they were. But eventually, it showed signs of clearing up.
Was it a prevalent illness amongst the troops, jaundice?
Well, jaundice was some people's idea. Right? Remember when I reported back to the unit, I'm jumping here, but when I eventually got back to the unit, there was others there who some had been wounded, some had been sick as well. And there was one of them, well before the commanding officer, and he said, "Oh, where were you wounded at?" Or there, or you were so wounded, he said, "Where were you wounded?" Then he came to one and, what were you away with there? And he says, "The yellow jaundice, sir." "Oh," he says, "I bet the officer's complaint was it." "Oh, you shouldn't drink so much." Anyhow, then he come to me and he says, "Yeah, what you were away with?" I said, "Oh, it was jaundice, another one of those buggers that was it, and passed on from there. But of course, from what you understand, jaundice could be caused not only through drinking and that. I mean, I wasn't an alcoholic or anything like that. I like to drink, but I never drank in excess. But you could get it in the living condition. the cold and wet, which I truly didn't mind, so I couldn't say I had enough to drink to close the illness.
Were they very heavily regimented, these hospitals? I'm thinking in terms of times that you had to get up and discipline and so forth.
They varied with you. It was, a medical officer would come round and see you, and so would the, like a matron, you can say. I suppose a matron was regimental in one sense, but that was more of the nurses keeping things tidy with your luxuries were far and few between in hospital. You didn't have your visitors coming up like you would in a normal hospital. But yes, cleanliness, of course, was one thing very insistent on. You had to definitely wash and shave and all that, keep as clean as you could.
You didn't have to lie to attention in bed, as I've been told.
No, yeah, well, I suppose it was a bit of a holiday in one sense. If you weren't feeling too good the weather and that, it was like you thought, well, you know, I could stick this life out to the end of the world once you're feeling a bit better. I remember on one of my toes, on the knuckle of my big toe, I had it looked like a displaced bit bone or something like that. So made up come round, so I played on this toe. I said, one thing, this toe, I said, non-roach march, is it, you know, it kills me, this and that. So I was having the toe, and I forget what he called it, like a piece of bone sticking on the street after the game. And he says, I don't think we can do it here. He says, because the alternative would be to take the toe off. But he says, at the stage it is now, he says, I don't think that's advisable. So what I was hoping, it might have got me out of the infantry as a with the foot, but no such luck. Anyhow, I say, I still have it today, it's a little bit bump, and it's something that's always stuck in my mind. I tried it out, but it didn't come off.
Was this a British manned hospital?
It was British. Well, I say British, it was South African doctors and nurses as well as British nurses used to run it. And one place in North Africa, I think after the Anglo job, the medical officer there, he was caught in a South African nurse. I don't remember that. But there was one, just one nationality. There was all sorts of the cleaning in hospitals as well. It was a lot of it was done by Italian women. They used to come and scrub it out and dust it out and that. But it used to be lovely in hospital. As I say, if you weren't feeling too ill, lovely, because everything was clean as possible. There was beds and there was sheets, which you weren't accustomed to for a while. And regular meals was something else. And if you were feeling a bit better, they used to kit you up with what they called hospital blues. Blue trousers and a blue jacket. I mean, it weren't tailor-made or anything like that. They just sort of hung on you and you called hospital blues, they called it. That would more or less go into a convalescent stage. You were allowed to walk out in the hospital grounds, but not out of the hospital grounds. The hospital grounds.
How did you get on with the nursing staff? And these would be young ladies you'd not seen for many a long time.
No, you would pass your comment, but I mean, there was that many of you, you know, if you were thought you were going to click, so that you would think that you were going to have a life of leisure. No, they would be friendly and that. There was not that I ever know, there was no shenanigans went on. They were sorry for you to see in the hospital and that. There's very few of them would be abrupt and that. Mind if they come to pull a sticking glass off anywhere, they're all about the same strength there, I think. Then they would comment, oh, look at the hair, look at the sticking glass there. No, but all in all, they were good at least, hospital. Well, I was very fortunate not to be wounded. I'm very sorry for those who were, but you have to go through it. But it's marvellous what they would really do for you. It wasn't a case of change his bandage and that's it, rip it up, bang another on and that's your gun. They would take the time and ask you how you felt and have you had word from home and things like that. So that was the hospital venture.
And then you said you went on to a transit camp.
Yes, went to a transit camp. The name just gone. But I know this transit camp we went in, and the four of us, I think, that sort of grouped together, all different regiments. We went into the office there, and the sergeant major produced a bag and told you to take a naffy token out of it. And there was a chap there, Ted Ross, they called him, and he came from Bethnal Green in London. And I was there, was a big lad as well, big weather, and my big man. And he put his hand in, and how many of these tokens he took out? I couldn't thought of this day. Of me, Joe Shook, being young and that, I only took me one token. So I've had to give me about half a room, and he still had a fistful left. But anyway, we got part of this transit camp, and it was more or less the formalities and that, like joining up again in one sense. You weren't given a lot of duties because you were still in the convalescent stage, but you weren't improving. And eventually, you'd go out back onto the firing range, and you didn't have your actual weapon with you, but the rifle was provided there. And got on the targets there, had a bit shoot at them, and you were more or less there waiting to be transferred to a unit.
Was it, again, very highly disciplined camp?
The camp was a sort of half and half, so it was to get you back to more or less the trained soldier period there. Get back to it, but it wasn't accessible. We didn't do route marches, these. I didn't do route marches there. But I would imagine that the maybe said you could stay at a training camp or transit camp maybe for a couple of weeks or something like that. Then you'd go on, but you never knew where you were going from there.
Who was staffing the camp?
The staff, you would find the staff with British soldiers, of course. And most of them were soldiers who had been wounded, so they were really like classed as they weren't A1, they were degraded and unfit for frontline service. But there again, they could be from all different regiments. For instance, North Africa, the transit camp which I mentioned previously, went to there. There was two of the chaps sort of helping run the camp, and only skeleton. And they had been paratroopers who had landed at Sousse in North Africa. They had been wounded and they were in the camp helping to run it.
Did they treat you all right? There was obviously they'd have experience of warfare anyway.
And then they would maybe get an ENSA concert come round as a source of entertainment. But from the camp, if it was near to a town, or so you were allowed into the town, but if there was a bit of distance between it, it was out of bounds, you couldn't go. We went into this town one night, and I thought we got into an Italian house, and we were talking and all that, and we ended up, they made us a big plate of spaghetti, which we enjoyed. But nothing really exciting happened from there.
So you got on pretty well with the Italian civilians that you did meet, that they tended to treat the British troops okay?
Yeah, they varied. I mean, yes, I met some nice Italians, some of them would love to have gone back and met them again, because a town, when you come out of action and put into a town or a village, that you were given what accommodation was available, and inevitably, some of the Italians were still living there, and some of them were empty, but some of them were occupied, but they still took you in. And I remember one, it was shortly before this jaundice really affected me, and we were in a brickworks where we were kept down, and next door to the brickworks was an Italian farm. And that would come about, I was with the medical section then, and the been a bridge that had been drawn between this and the nearest village. And there was a truck had been going up there, and one of the lads in the back of the truck had overturned, and it, he'd gone under the truck and it killed him. And this, I remember the Italian farmer, he come up to me and said about this dead sword, and he says, could he have his boots? You know, well, you know, he only got my boot, and yet, no. But that was the case, this fellow got killed, and they put him into a hut near this brickworks, and the sergeant at the time asked me if I would go and take his personal effects off him and prepare him for burial. So that's when I was with the medical section.
Were you with the medical section before you got jaundice?
I was actually with the medical section when I got
jaundice. Possibly we can deal with that now then, because we may miss it. What was your job with that section?
Well, the medical section, that's right, the medical section. After I got back to the unit again, and before the CO, and the CO said to the transport officer who was there, did he want me back on transport? And, oh yes, he said, definitely. So I was transferred back to transport section.
Is this after the hospital?
After the hospital, yes. But eventually come back to the battalion, the Oxen Box. And I expected to be going back onto the 1500 weight anti-tank truck. And instead of that, when I got back to him, he says, oh man, he said, I want you to take over the medical truck. So that was a 3-tonne truck it was, the medical truck at that time. So I took it over, and he says, you can also do a bit of stretching there. So that's how I come to be onto the medical truck.
I thought that it was before your hospitalisation, but it was after.
Yes. Yeah.
So you'd been to the transit camp for a whole long?
I should say around about a fortnight before we moved up. Mm-hmm. I must have moved up through other transit camps, and eventually got back to the battalion.
Did you think what date this would be?
I'm almost a bit blank here. I just can't remember what date it would be.
But anyway, you came back to the... You came back to the battalion. Do you recall where they were when you joined them or rejoined them?
I believe it was Fawley. I wouldn't like to swear at it. I believe it was Fawley. I know there was only a few houses there, and I reported back, and they said, I'm sorry, I'm better. After reporting back, instead of going to meet the old job, as it were, on this anti-tank truck, I was told to take over the medical truck, 3-tonner. And from there, told by the medical officer that I'd be doing a bit of stretcher bearing as well when required. So he issued me with a Red Cross card in the event of being taken prisoner that had to be treated as with the Geneva Convention. You never have to use it, of course. They always carried it about me. But the funny thing as well, which I shouldn't have had, was a weapon in the cab of the truck. Which also, whilst trying to be a Red Cross man, is also armed as a soldier. But of course, I didn't use to carry the weapon if I did a bit of stretcher bearing. So that was a new experience, but I didn't get any training as per se. It was more or less what I picked up. And if it come to a wounded soldier when in action, went to get him with a case of, if he hadn't put a bandage on himself, he would take his shell dressing out of his pocket or out of the net from under it, which was always tin hat. Between the tin hat and the net, that we often had a dressing there as well. Put his bandage him up best you could. He had a few dressings with you as well, of course. Get him on a stretcher and get him to the first aid course where the medical officer was, and then he'd inspect the wounds and treat him up. You were dropping off there, and where you went back again, you were with the platoon you were with, accompanied. In the event of anybody getting wounded, there was always a call for stretcher bearers, and that was your move. You were up off your backside if you were on it, and go and try and get the lad back.
Did you work in pairs?
Oh yes, you need two for the stretcher, to carry the stretcher as well.
Did you carry anything else with you in addition to wound dressings, shell dressings?
Just the dressings. You had a haversack with a sling that was slung over in the haversack at your side, and there were shell dressings in there and that.
Did you have the armband on as part of your dress?
Yes, a khaki armband about 3 inches, 3 to 4 inches, and then a red cross on it. But most of them haven't. I mean, you're supposed to give respect to red crosses and treat it as to what they were. But I have known a wounded soldier being on the stretcher and been carrying him at shoulder with the stretcher handles on our shoulder, and he's been sniped at by a German wounded soldier.
Do you recall any particular instances where you were in action as a stretcher bearer?
Yeah, that was one of them. That was one of the ones carrying that. Another one, Dandridge, he was a stretcher bearer as well. With another stretcher he was, I know they picked a chap up with wounded from the soldiers and got the bandage up, what wounds they could find on him, but when they got him back to the medical officer had been wounded in the back, which hadn't been noticed, and the stretcher was covered in blood, right, and of course he'd left it there. But you could be treating them, and then shells would come over, or mortars. I wouldn't say I encountered much small arms fire, apart from that one I remember when this chap was shot on the stretcher. But it was shell fire and mortar fire. You could be carrying and then you have to drop. I mean, the occasion when the sword would fall off the stretcher, you just died for your own life, more or less. You didn't use it more on purpose or anything like that. But that's when you're carrying them at arms down by your sides in that position. It's very rarely we got them up onto our shoulders, and that was if the terrain was a bit off.
But as a stretcher bearer, were you ever operating between yourself, your own men, and the enemy, with wounded that had fallen in between?
But you were more or less in the front line. If you got to what you call no man's land, so I'll give you an instance there. We were actually out of the line at the time, but there was a no man's land. And the medical officer said, one of the companies, there was some of the men laid out, and would I go down with a medical truck? This wasn't a 3-tonner truck, this was another one which I got later, jumping over it. It was a Dodger, I remember, 1500 weight. And it had been fitted out with a stretcher each side in the back of it, just a canvas top over that. And he said, would I go down and get these bodies? So there was two of us went down, and it was like a cultivated field, down there, growing potatoes or something like that, in this field. And we went down to pick these lads up, we didn't know where they were. When we got there, it was more or less a section. We had 8 or 9 of them. And they were in a line, just as they must have been advancing across this field. Because I say, this is no man's land. And we started picking them up, and the first one I remember, he had a row of bullet holes through his arm, and they'd gone through his arm into his body, others on. And during that time, there was not a couple of mortars came over at us, whether it was just incidental that I don't know. But we got them onto the back of this truck and then went back to where the medical officer was in this house. And then, of course, we had a burial party to bury them. One was a South African officer, I remember. And when we picked him up, one at the head for the shoulders, the other at the feet, and as he sort of bent a bit and uttered a googling sort of sound, you know, but then you would take one of the identities. Every soldier had two identities, the red one and the green coloured one. And you used to take one off with his pay book. Well, he didn't have a pay book when he went into Oxford, he'd take this coloured disc off to train that the padre would eventually get that, and then this family would be glorified from the commander. So, and the other disc was left on him, and there were this burial party, we were digging graves, I know, and then there was a soldier couldn't pass it, he had six German prisoners. So we got all of the German prisoners and got them to do the digging for the graves. And the lad you buried, and then the marker was put on. If there was he had an empty tin or some sort of container like that, you put his disc into there. In the chest of the man at the window, only to see it on his chest. Then this you could see it.
And the marker, how did you mark the graves?
The mark of the pioneers, we put a stake, the pioneer platoon, and they would have a stake, a map reference was made of the grave locations, and the stake would be put in. And afterwards it would be, I suppose, really like the Graves Commission would follow you up, and they would have the nasty job of digging up the bodies again and taking them to a war cemetery. It was identified by the disc that was with him. Odd time you would see a rifle with a bayonet attached to the tin I put on it and see that in all sorts of cards. That was very rare. It was all some sort of back or a vein or two with a tin hat on it, just to find it.
You must have tread wounded and dead comrades with a certain amount of carefulness. And
you had a feeling. You get a feeling that you never sort of forget. I mean, the body was stone cold. You know, just it's funny really, because I'm so sentimental about these things, but at the time, after I'd done it a few times, there wasn't that feeling about you that it was a dead person. Naturally you'd think of town, well, who was he? Was he married? Did he have a family? Or what? All these sorts would go through your mind. Look, I was saying this soldier that went under the lorry when we were near the brickwork, so I'd ask me to do a burial. But to do a burial, if you had a blanket, you would wrap the soldier up in the blanket and then get some signal wire, which is used by the signals, I suppose, and just tie that round him. If you could cross his arm, if the water wasn't so bad, cross his arm and put the wire. He'd go round his neck and round the chest and the waist and further down to the US. He got to the ankles and then just placed in the grave.